During the COVID-19 pandemic, states in the Middle East and across the world have taken extreme steps in granting themselves emergency powers to deal with an unprecedented situation. But many people have raised concerns that such measures and their implementation have the potential to infringe on human rights and must be monitored carefully. In this podcast, Finulani Airline, UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights While Countering Terrorism, and Sarah Elizabeth Dill, International Law and Human Rights Expert and Arab Regional Forum Liaison Officer for the IBA's War Crimes Committee, consider the issues. To begin, Dill stresses that emergency powers must fit specific criteria in order to be exercised responsibly. The airline goes on to outline fears and hopes regarding the potential overreach of exceptional powers during and post-crisis.
You need to have specific requisites and you need to have oversight, something that is occurring. The emergency measures legislation has to be separate and distinct from your everyday legislation, which it recognizes how different it is, that they're harsh, they're draconian at times, but they need to be to protect human lives. So when you have something like this, it has emergency provisions. It has enabling powers for the making of further emergency laws under solely the pandemic. But also a provision, for example, that once the act is repealed, either through an act of a parliament or other legislative body, or via a sunset provision, which is essential in all of these, every law made under it is automatically repealed. But then you see as some governments are reverting to use their national security powers to more broadly attempt to suppress dissidents. And that, of course, becomes a problem. It's important to educate the public that government's powers during a pandemic are temporary, they're limited in scope, they're limited in time, and there needs to be a continuous reevaluation of those powers.
I think we are facing both a global health pandemic, but also an epidemic of exceptional powers. In times of crisis, which include health crisis, under international law, states do have the right to limit certain rights specifically to help them confront or manage an exceptional situation like a health pandemic. But the key point is that it's not a blank check and that states, in fact, there are limits to the powers and the exceptions that a state can invoke. And the bottom line is that any measure taken has to be clearly linked to the health challenge, not essentially an excuse to do that which could not be done otherwise. In many states, what we see is a sense of power grab by states. We see expansive legislation which do a number of things. They restrict the power of legislatures, and it's all the more important in our view at this time that, in fact, legislatures and the regular oversight processes of government remain in place. We also need to see really clear consequences for states when they, in fact, abuse the privilege that they are allowed to take exceptional measures. Generally, states don't give away power that they've amassed. They tend to hold on to those powers. So while we might find justifications for certain uses of these powers in the short time, the real rub is going to come the day after. I think we just have a really good track record of measuring that across multiple legal systems, whether it's the state of siege in French and other civil law systems, to the use of martial law powers or the centralization of executive powers in common law systems through the First and the Second World War. We know that actually those powers that were taken in these times of crisis have actually become hardwired. We've certainly seen that post 9/11 legislation in many countries, which was supposed to be short term after the events of 9/11, have essentially become normalized in a range of countries. And if we take countries in the Middle East, my mandate recently issued a review of Egyptian counterterrorism legislation and noted that Egypt has been in a permanent state of emergency for multiple years. Now, where we do have some positive examples is in the area of health emergencies. We have had health emergencies previously. The H1N1 virus is a very good example of where a number of states took exceptional measures during H1N1 in the health space. And actually, the example there has been that states in that H1N1 virus largely gave back those powers at the end, including quarantines and limitations on freedom of movement. So I think what we need to be pressing is that health-related emergency powers end when the health crisis ends.
Dill emphasises the view that robust mechanisms can ensure that emergency powers remain limited, and that international influence may also play a role.
As long as we have the transparency, as long as we have the monitoring, as long as we look to human rights bodies or, you know, even government pressure. But I also think that a lot of these countries have been doing a lot in terms of human rights in recent years. And so, yes, you have the outliers, but countries that depend on international business, international trade, tourism, are going to hesitate before having things that will make someone pause. And so I think from that perspective, as we've seen such a relaxing of restrictions and a modernization in a lot of these countries, that concern is not as much in some places, although in others, it is something we have to look at.
Achieving a balance between necessary emergency legislation in the name of public health and other fundamental human rights and civil liberties is crucial, but far from easy to achieve, says Dill. The airline agrees, also pointing to positive engagement from civil society and a need to protect fundamental rights in order to respond to the crisis adequately.
It is a delicate balance when you're dealing in a pandemic. And I think that's where it's most important to remember that the right to life and the right to health are essentially the most important rights. And what governments and others attempt to do during a pandemic is to protect an individual's right to life. And because it's a unique situation where basic daily activities can put a person's life at risk from another, that we see the emergency legislation that's coming out. And there are concerns when you look at prisons, when you look at the right to work, the right to move, the right to simply leave one's house. And so there's a delicate balance that has to occur in these situations. One of the problems that we have is that you have governments and legislators and rulers making decisions on things that are constantly changing. And I do not envy them in this time. Generally, for something like this, you want to have the least restrictive means possible when you're enacting these emergency powers. That's not always easy to tell when you're dealing with a pandemic. The problem that then occurs is that from a public health and a medical standpoint, the advice is that you're going to want to err on the side of maybe a least restrictive plus one, because you are dealing with human life.
There's a global recognition both from the Secretary General's office, from the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights, that actually human rights challenges are part and parcel of the COVID-19 landscape. And if we think of other crises, I'm thinking of, let's say, the security crisis that befell the world post 9/11, there was a much slower human rights response. So I'm heartened, actually, in some ways, that we see civil society voices, that we see lawyers, that we see international institutions actually using the language of rights. The second thing is, I do think that this has changed our way of thinking about rights. So fundamental conversations like the right to health and the right to safe water is, in fact, part of the conversation of states in a way that I think might be very difficult to advance prior to COVID-19. So there are some odd rights upsides to this. The rights discussion here isn't just a discussion about the repression of civil and political rights, but it is also an understanding of the indivisibility of rights, that only in protecting essential economic and social rights, including, of course, the right to health and the right to access to health for all people equally and without discrimination, can states and the world, in fact, respond to this crisis adequately.
Measures taken during COVID-19 have varied between Middle Eastern countries. Some have taken positive steps and looked to preserve rights, while others have fallen short, says Dill.
As we've seen in Qatar, there has been a long concern about their labor camps and their laws governing the migrant workers, especially on the World Cup sites. This was a concern that existed long before COVID. Qatar was very slow in making improvements and implementing laws and doing things vis-a-vis some of the other countries in the region and what they were doing. But as we've seen the reports coming out in the midst of COVID, where as you have other countries in the Gulf as you looked at Kuwait and UAE making special efforts to protect against the spread of COVID within the labor camps and specific restrictions. Dubai's reopening plan contains very, very detailed processes to protect construction workers and laborers versus Qatar, where you saw, and we've had reports about a horrific spread about COVID-19 within the labor camps, where you had the forced deportation of the Nepalis who were told that they were going to be tested for COVID and get medical treatment, and instead they were deported. And so I do think that there is something from the international community to watch in these governments and see what they're going to do about this and make sure that these powers and restrictions are limited in time and do not continue once the threat of the pandemic has ended. One thing that is troubling is what is happening in Jordan right now. We're seeing a lot of reports that they are arresting as many as 800 people each day for violating quarantine and lockdown restrictions. This does pose a problem because, in addition to the question of whether or not arresting people is the correct response to this, whilst most countries do have provisions in their laws and special orders for stay at home and quarantine that allow for a jail sentence, most countries, even in the Gulf and the Middle East, are simply issuing citations and monetary fines, not arresting people and putting them in prison. This does pose a greater risk for spread of the virus when you're putting that many people in close, crowded conditions, likely with lack of masks, gloves, and other protective equipment and the ability to sanitize. But also, we have concerns about due process and human rights because you have the inability of lawyers to meet with their clients face-to-face. Courts are mostly closed or on very restricted procedures during this time. And so there's a question of how long these people are going to be held. And so I do think we need to keep an eye on what's happening in Jordan and if this starts to happen in other places. But I also think that provides a means for some diplomatic and other discussions that arresting people may not necessarily be the best solution in a situation like this.
Many states in the Middle East and worldwide have taken action regarding social media posts, journalism, and freedom of expression related to COVID-19 and state responses to it. It's important to balance combating widespread fake news and misinformation with ensuring that legitimate criticism and reporting does not suffer, and that punishments are proportionate, says Dill, highlighting different approaches across the Middle East.
Freedom of speech is also an issue during this time. And unfortunately, the age we live in, information travels instantly. Fake news is a common thing. You have clickbait all over social media. But most troubling is that you also have really bad information that could harm people, whether it comes from otherwise reputable sources or simply just through the rumor mill, which was something that was exceptionally a problem in the Middle East when COVID-19 first broke. The UN and the WHO have even set up special websites to dispel myths. And so this is why I believe governments are rightfully concerned about misinformation. Obviously, that does pose a concern when you have to balance that with critiques or questions about what governments are doing. You have countries like Turkey that have been overly harsh in their restrictions on speech and on the press under President Erdogan. They've enacted a very tough social media rule. It becomes problems. And I think that when you look at countries that are trying to control misinformation versus critiques of the government, there's a very fine line to walk. You have many countries that have imposed fines for spreading misinformation about the pandemic. Others, sadly, I think Hungary, South Africa, and a few, I believe the Philippines, have potential jail sentences. Thailand, I think you can get up to 5 years in prison for spreading misinformation, whereas many of the countries in the Gulf and elsewhere simply have imposed fines. Dubai, during the pandemic, launched major media and social media campaigns in the Middle East. They saw what was being spread in terms of rumors. They made great attempts to dispel those myths. They had question and answer abilities for the public to say, this is what I've heard. Is this true? Is this false? And they really engaged in an awareness campaign, recognizing what was happening in terms of misinformation. Then you look at Iran, which has a staggering number of cases. Most of the world thinks that it's what they're reporting is significantly less than what they actually have. And they've gone on a propaganda counteroffensive. In addition to their traditional restrictions on speech and shutting down the internet, they accused the U.S. of spreading the coronavirus as they called it, an ethnic weapon against Iranians.
International institutions have a role to play in future pandemics in monitoring human rights, says Dill. And they also need to maintain a focus on longer-term structural issues, says Nierlein.
The primary things that we need to do are, one, look to see whether there's a mechanism within the UN that would monitor and react to complaints of repressive rights regimes, either during the pandemic or following the end of it. We've looked at how do we long-term put together a blueprint and standards of pandemic legislation, recognizing that each pandemic or emergency situation will be a little bit different, but that we should come up with something that's a standard, that, and whether this is through a modification to the WHO international health regulations, which were last modified in 2005, which do address human rights concerns, or whether we have an independent, whether through the United Nations or otherwise, come together to develop kind of a model law for what nations should do when these things happen.
One of the challenges in a COVID-19 crisis is that what dominates is short-term thinking, and what we have to do at simultaneously, none of which is easy, which is both to focus on the short-term products, if you want, that we're seeing in various states, and also to be aware of the long-term structural causes for human rights violations that are taking place. Let us hope that the day after the global pandemic ends, that these structural and fundamental questions will be on the table, precisely because they will be continue to be relevant even as we think about the next global pandemic after this one.